chocolate. Get the waitress.
Shh, Rashi, come on. I brought you to the magic show here because you seem to be interested in magic. I thought you'd learn something.
Oh, my God. Look at that guy. He might find a rabbit in that hat, but he'll never find his dignity. Boo! Suck! Give me a hot chocolate.
This is Radio Rashi, Once in Future Thing Part 4 with Wes McDonough and Jonathan Pendragon. We return with Jonathan recounting a tale of survival.
I've nearly died, like, I don't know, I stopped counting. But the tiger, the shark, the arrow through my heart, an attempted suicide on pills, flying into a dark cloud with my airplane at night where I couldn't see where I was going.
Holy
and I had
cow.
No, I was flying between Vegas and Reno, and there was a clear night with a full moon, and there was a forest fire in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and there was a black cloud coming across my path, but no one had reported it because most of the commercial aircraft, of course, were much higher than it.
Sure.
So all of a sudden I'm flying and I can't see it. I mean, flying on a full moon, you know, the ground's pretty well illuminated, and it's not that dangerous. I actually like flying at night a lot. All of a sudden, boom, I'm in the middle of a cloud, and what it's doing is it's making the full moon is making the cloud like you're inside of a fluorescent tube.
Yeah, it's like refraction, it's all over the place.
You're in a whiteout. High beams on a foggy night.
That's right. Yeah. You're in a whiteout, and again the moon's over my head, so I can't use it for a reference. And there's a thing called the 1 minute rule. I was not an instrument trained pilot at the time. I was what we call VFR, visual flight rules, and we call it the 1 minute rule. If you're not out into a visual reference plane within a minute, the odds are you'll die. You'll disorient.
Whoa.
And you'll go into a spiral and a spin and you're dead. And so I thought, I got a minute to get out of this thing. And I thought, well, I can't fly above it because I don't know how high it is. I can't, where do I turn? I don't know anything. The only thing that I know that where I could really have a reference point is the ground below me. If I can fly below this, maybe there's enough moonlight I'll be able to see land, you know, see the earth. Mm-hmm. and fly. I have to fly close, but it's my only chance.
Mm-hmm.
So I trimmed my plane to fly as level as it could. I started a slow spiral down. And I was in that cloud for like 5 minutes.
Holy shit.
You know, yeah. But whenever I felt disorientation, and I felt it badly, I was sweating. I was one of the most terrifying moments of my life. I let go of the plane because I trimmed it perfectly and it would fly straight and level. Mm. And I would, you know, take a deep breath and I would spiral down. And finally I broke out from below the cloud and I could see the side of a mountain going down towards I-95, and I turned towards I-95, and there was a truck that was, you know, down the side of the mountain. I flew to it and then flew over the top of the truck and basically followed it into Hawthorne, which was the nearest the airport. And it was, you know, it was, I used all my skill and all everything I had to stay alive.
What a tremendous gift the universe gave you. Here's a truck. We're going to guide you in.
Yeah.
And that has happened to you so many times.
So many times. And it was...
I mean, that would be a really nice allegory. Like if you were writing an autobiography, well, it's like, here's your truck. You know what I mean?
But again and
like,
again. I mean...
I've never heard that story. That is amazing. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, it's but your point is well taken. It's happened to me again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say suffer because it's not a suffer. I have what's called delayed startle effect, which means you can startle me. If you jump up, come up behind me and go, boo, I'll jump. Mm-hmm. But in a crisis, I don't freak. I don't panic.
I get
afterwards and then I'm shaking for an hour and a half. But at the moment of crisis, time slows. My head, I'm completely clear. And I go, okay, what are my options?
It's a heightened lucidity for
you.
It's
very lucid for me. And then, and it with the tiger, with the shark, with the hitting the arrow hitting me in the heart, all those times this showed up and saved my life. The one accident was that when I wanted to die, and it's a long story when I wanted to die, and I never thought this is something I would want, but I was destroyed in so many different ways by nature and by someone I really loved, that I took a whole handful of lorazepam and a glass of wine. And I don't really like wine.
Ooh.
You know,
yeah,
but
that's...
I, you know. So what happened was I drank it and then apparently the wine hit my stomach wrong and it all pretty much came up. But by that time I was unconscious. I thought I was falling asleep and never waking up again.
Wow.
One of my neighbors happened to see me and thought, and knew of course of my troubles at the time, and said, my God, he looks... in really horrible shape and called the police. So I fall asleep and I'm unconscious for 2 days. And I wake up in the hospital and I'm alone.
Wow.
And which is not the best place to wake up that way. So and when I go unconscious, I think, oh, that's it, I'm gonna die now. And 2 days later I wake up in the hospital, I'm in the hospital bed, I'm looking up and I'm going, you gotta be fucking kidding me. I'm still alive. What does it take to knock me off? I mean, it was like, it wasn't, you know, it was like this cruel cosmic joke. I mean, you know, God's playing with me. Yeah, you're going to stay alive. You know, it was.
No, your work's
if
not
you've ever
yet.
Seen
no.
the movie The Fall, he's so identified
yeah.
with
yeah,
that
there's
yeah.
a movie
scene
called
where
The Fall
he wakes
where this...
up from his attempted suicide.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But then you all know, of a sudden yeah. it said, okay, all right, pretty much, you got to stay alive. I mean, because this can't be coincidence. And then I meet West. And here is this person who I adore, who is my perfect match, and who loves the things I love. Mm-hmm. She goes, you've got to watch this TV show. And if you don't like this TV show, I can't be with you. And it was Pushing Daisies. And I love, oh, and I just fell in love with Pushing Daisies immediately because it was really well written, really well done.
Yeah, all of his shows are great. The 6 Feet Under, I think it was one of his, right? No, yeah. not 6 Feet
Under. No. He did Wonderfall.
Wonderfall.
Dead Like Me.
Yeah, Dead Like Me.
Yeah, and I was just, I'm going, wow, I've never seen Pushing Daisies. And actually, this is really, really great. And then, of course, our favorite movie together is Monty Python and the Holy Grail. We could do it from beginning to end, verbatim.
Yeah, you can.
And,
you both can.
You know, and then... I was saying, you know, I really want to work on a new character when I'm not doing the things, you know, because, you know, I wanted to develop the OCD act, which is the high functioning savant act. And then, you know, you and I came up with our idea for the mystical and the rational.
Well, and that's a natural fit anyway. And we'll talk more about metaphysics in a minute, but anyway.
But as far as the other side of my character, the illusion character, I had to be a magician by myself. And, uh-huh. and I was just talking, I said, you know, I used to collect graphic novels, and there was one graphic novel that I really liked, and I only had the first book of it, and it was called Sandman, and the character is Morpheus. He's the, you know, the, and then before I can say it, Wes goes, the anthropomorphic, how do you describe
it?
It's
an anthropomorphic, personification.
Yeah,
an anthropomorphic.
Yeah, of the dream state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I said, oh, you know this. And she says, yes, I've actually met Neil Gaiman. And I'm going, oh, my God, I really like his work. You know, mm-hmm. and she knows Neil Gaiman, you know. Mm-hmm. And then
Bugsy is not impressed Bugsy.
For any of this, the snoring sound is not any of the people in the room.
Bugsy's sorry, Neil Gaiman's
a dog. There is right. a very tired dog here.
So one of her first gifts is the entire collection of Neil Gaiman's work of the Sandman.
Well, that
series.
Was even more than Pushing Daisies. That was one of if he wasn't into yeah. that, he could not be in a relationship.
It's a litmus
Sorry.
Test.
But
yeah,
so now and so now what's happened then is that the people who I've really admired in my life, like your husband, like Paul, who's a storyteller,
mm-hmm.
and like Neil, who's a storyteller. Now I'm meeting them. I never met them before. I mean, I always met a lot of famous people.
You knew Paul before I knew.
What?
You knew Paul before I did.
I know. Not on that, but not on the level that I know him now.
Yeah.
You know, not on the level where I can talk about something I really care a lot about, which is the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And like when I met Neil for the very first time was at one of his, and I see him from about 15 feet away. I'm walking down, and he goes. Looks at me, he goes, Jonathan Pendragon, I really like your work. And you know my work? And I said, oh, yes, I love magic. And I went, oh, my God. And then we go to the WFC, the World Fantasy Conference, which is primarily writers and all that. And there is James Blaylock and William K. Jeter and Tim Powers, basically the fathers of contemporary steampunk.
Uh-huh.
And I start talking to them. And I find out they're from Orange County, where I was born.
Yeah.
And Blaylock taught at Cal State Fullerton, where my mother taught.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
And they hung out at this bar in Orange that I know. And they're Tim, I think, is my age. But
and let me just insert here. You had already come to a steampunk sort of feel for your work on your own without ever even being familiar with the term. In fact, Paul was the first one who said, the four of us went out to dinner And he was describing where his work was going, and Paul said, well, that sounds like steampunk.
Yeah.
And I said, what?
And he's like, what's that?
And then immediately they're both on their phones going, oh my God, look at this. Oh, yeah. We can get one of these.
Yeah.
Oh, this will be perfect. Yeah. Oh my God.
That's right. That's right, Paul. You told me what it was called. Yeah. I didn't know it had.
Which we knew from going to Comic-Con
and
stuff.
I didn't even know it had a name.
So then I go to WC and here are these three guys, and we're all within 3 years of the same age. We're all from Orange County. Uh-huh. And when I was in college, my uncle took me to meet Philip K. Dick. Mm-hmm. I only met him once. And I wish I'd known more about him when I met him.
I know, that's what I'm jealous of.
I actually got to meet him. You know, jealous. And I found out that when Philip was dying, these were the guys that were taking care of him.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
They took care of this giant of science fiction, and mm-hmm. who was one of my favorite writers. And it was like, so now I'm meeting these guys, and then I got to bring him to the Magic Castle performing on stage, and you know, James Blaylock and Tim Powers are in, and we're going out to dinner, and it's like, I'm going like, I look back at my life before the suicide attempt and after the suicide attempt, mm-hmm. and it's like, okay, that was one life, this is a second life, but this, and Wes always goes, well, this is your step on the hero's journey.
Yes.
And that's what she always relates it to. So she actually, you know.
What was that called? The belly of the whale? Isn't that the...
The belly of the beast. Yeah.
Belly of the beast. Belly of the beast. Yeah.
Belly of the whale. That's pretty Pinocchio.
After the belly of the
Noah.
Beast.
Yeah.
Or Noah.
Jonah.
After the belly of the beast.
Jonah, right.
Jonah,
yeah.
After the belly of the beast, the darkest hour, then comes the meeting with the goddess.
Or the Pinocchio phase.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Hold on.
Although it's called, in the Bible, it's called a great fish.
Yes. And then.
So it goes the belly of the beast, the darkest hour. Hold on. They didn't hear you. Say it again.
And then it's the meeting of the with the goddess.
Start over from the very beginning.
It's the belly of the beast. Well, first of all, it's the call to adventure, the refusal of the call, then you become the wanderer, then you become the warrior, and then during that time you wind up in the belly of the beast. You have the meeting with the goddess, you have the magic journey, you have the reunification with the father, where you resolve issues from your father or yourself or other generations or things from your previous childhood. Yeah. And then you become the master of both worlds, the real world and the spiritual world. If I'm getting any of this out of order, and I probably am, please, George Lucas, don't come down on me like a ton of bricks. But it's all in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And so then comes your sex.
Yes. That's right.
Which we saw spam a lot.
I'll put that on my resume.
No, that line is, I'm going.
You can use me as a reference.
That line isn't actually even in there. Which, you know, they use a lot of the great lines from the movie.
Right.
But that, matter of fact, the Catho Anthrax, they got women in the costumes, but there's no Catho Anthrax segment, which I thought was, oh, no. And
there wasn't when we saw it either.
Yeah, there isn't one. They may have written and dropped it, but there were women in the costumes, but you know.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And the final stage is the danger field resolution, which is from the ending of Back to School. Hey, everybody, we're all going to get laid.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. I'm kidding. Yeah.
There also isn't the Bridge of Destiny or the Bridge of Doom.
Yeah, I have the...
You know.
What is your quest? What is the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow?
I don't know. Yeah.
African or European swallow?
I don't know that.
I don't know.
but that's the hero's journey. It's in there in some form or another, and those are the elements that you, and a lot of that is in fiction, you know, like a literal example is something like Pinocchio, you know, where, you know, he does.
He literally ends up in the belly of the beast.
He winds up in the belly of the beast. And then the blue fairy is a guiding force throughout his life who, if I remember the book correctly, he actually goes to her after he and Geppetto escape from the giant dogfish or shark. And it's not a whale in the book. And he cares for her because she's gotten sick. And because, you know, it's like he has to atone for the wickedness he's done. So he first cares for his father, then he cares for the fairy. He even goes to visit his old friend Lampwick, who has been turned into a donkey, and comforts him in his dying hour. And, you know, throughout, works hard and says farewell to his old tempters, the fox and cat, who are in bad shape. And then once he's put his past behind him, he wakes up one morning and the puppet's lying in a corner and he's a real boy. And, you know, that's a story about literal transformation, spiritual and physical transformation, a lot harsher than what Walt Disney the elements that Walt Disney chose for his movie, but still, you know, a lot of it has the same feel.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that always draws me to the narrative part of performance, and it always has.
Yeah.
You look at most magic, and there's almost no narrative whatsoever.
It's trick.
It's trick, and it just it bores the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And so I said, what is it that I can bring? Okay, I'm 58 now, so I brought a great deal of physicality to my younger performances and romanticism because it's the character that I played. What can I bring now? Mm-hmm. What is it that you love? Well, I love storytelling.
Uh-huh.
And I said, can I bring that to? And you know, there have been magicians who have done that not particularly well. I mean, it's very dangerous because you've got to really be good at it. I mean, it's not something you start going into storytelling and it can become sappy really really fast. And it's I've seen it, and it's like I go, ugh, you know, it's just shut up and do the trick.
Terrified that's gonna happen. I mean, he asks me all the time when we're doing something. Yeah. Oh no, is that just too trite?
Am I getting too trite? And I do go over the line sometimes. I get trite, and I try to pull back. But I know it's successful because the one comment that I constantly get from my performance is people walk up to me and say, you know what I love about your magic? It's the storytelling. And I'm not, you know, and I don't sit there like, you know, I'm going to once upon a time or I'm going to tell you a story. I don't do that. I just tell the story. It is like in medias res. I'm in the middle. I'm here. And we're in the middle of the sequence and I'm going to tell you the story. And so I use framing devices to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm not playing, I'm trying to think. Celestial Navigation.
Mm-hmm.
You remember them? Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't remember the name of the main actor. The main actor who played the head of this group. Celestial Navigation was a band, and one of the guys in it was Jeffrey. He was a lot of the. He was in Clint Eastwood's friends. He was in a lot of the films.
Huh. Okay.
And apparently, and this is a true story. When he was a kid, his father traveled for a living, and as a boy, he saw the storytellers, like in Marrakesh, who would sit by a fire and tell stories, and it fascinated him. So he wrote all these stories. They're very Hemingway in the way that he does them. And he's got a band behind him, so there's the music, and he walks forward. He's usually got a light source, which reminds you of a fire, and he tells these stories with the band behind him. I think what's most inspirational about it is that the storyteller doesn't have any props. All the props or with the voice, and they create the mood with their voice. They make you feel it with their voice, and that is such a powerful instrument for the audience. Because magicians depend so much on their props, you know, their cards, whatever, their illusions. So I wanted to affect the audience in a way I couldn't do it just with a prop act. I had to venture into this storytelling realm, and I had to be honest about it because I the thing about magicians is they tell so many phony stories and they sound so trite and so patently, you know, interchangeable, you know, that
they just switch nouns around.
That's right. You know, saying the exact same story.
Yeah.
It is boring.
Your props are there to enhance your stories. Your stories are not there to enhance your props.
Right. Well, and you specifically have. I'm sorry, West. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I'm just saying that's where the difference is. I see from the majority of what I see.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that do tell stories, it's, well, I've got this effect, and so here's something I can come up with to say whether it happened or not. And often you can tell that never happened at all.
When I tell a story, 95% of it's true.
Mm-hmm.
I just alter things that help the story, but I don't exaggerate them that much, and so that I can, you know, when I'm telling them, I'm telling the truth, and so the audience, I hope, is feeling that there really is meaning behind this for me, that there is a truth in this for me.
And the other thing is that it's not a static thing. I mean, I've worked with you now for about a year and a half that we've actually worked together, and of all the shows you've done in that time. You'll repeat a show within the same booking, but I've never seen you do the exact same show from one booking to the next. It's always evolving. I mean, you've worked with them How many times have you done your show in the Feller? Is three or four?
Be our third run.
You're going on your third run.
Yeah.
I thought you were going on your fourth for some reason.
This might be our fourth. Well, you know what? We were booked, and then the fire happened.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so this is our third.
This is our third.
Nick.
And I really like...
Because there was the one that we just taped with your camera, and it never actually came out. And then there were two that we got professionally taped. So this will be your fourth.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right.
And... Every single time, does he not get into the same? We got to change this around. We got to change this around, and everything.
I really like
recreated fresh. I mean, because his journey is in a new place every time, and that's been one of the blessings of what you've been able to do.
As has mine
in this stage.
Yep. And one of the things that we did this specific time, when the three of us sat down and had our first meeting about what we were planning on doing, you know, because Wes produces the show that we work together on. Which means that she does a lot of the work, frankly. And we love you and we appreciate you. But one of the first things that we sat down is we had a character meeting. And Jonathan is actually doing, he's got a full character lecture and some wonderful notes. Can they buy those notes online, Jonathan? Are they available yet, or is it something that
I got to do that. I'm lazy. I'm not lazy. I'm a workaholic. But I'm always trying to create something. You know, like you saw the Necronomicon.
Yeah.
I made one for Neil. Don't tell him.
Good.
Is this going to air before we hear? Oh, we want to hear.
Yes,
this.
But okay. I don't think
okay.
I'm here.
So it's cool. It's one of those fake books that you open up.
Yeah.
And so I've gotten really good at it. So I take leather and I take material like. Cloth material, mm-hmm. and I age it,
and then I
do all this with hot gluing it, and so basically I've created a Necronomicon that when you open it up, you can put one of other Neil's books inside, so you can walk us into Necronomicon, open it up, and then pull out American Gods.
Yeah,
so it's great, like great. You'll love that.
It's fabulous.
And I'm working on one for you.
Oh.
Yes, I am. That's going to be a book of spells.
Tell people.
She's going to see it because, you know, but yours is
going to give you the surprise. And here's
No.
He's
but
just
yours...
like me, isn't he? How much alike are we? Yeah, we're pointing at each other right now.
But,
how much alike are we?
Very close.
I was going to make you a Necronomicon. I go, she's going to I know. I'll make Misty a book of spells. So I'm going to make you a book of spells. You'll have to change the technique again and come up with something different. But I love doing that.
I have a book you made me a long time ago. You gave me a book in my birthday gift. You gave me.
I love
it. Years ago, he created a magic effect for me with a caterpillar that becomes a butterfly.
Oh, yes.
And I still have it. He packaged it in a book that he had decorated and made with my own personal magic wand.
Yeah.
Handmade by John, and I still have
He's
all
so
of
wonderfully
these things.
Creative, though.
Oh, it's amazing! Yeah.
But I'm actually working on a lecture. I was going to do it for I'm thinking about doing it for my next. If I do a series of articles for Magic Newswire called Jonathan Pendragon: The Search for the Grail, which is again a nod to Pendragon as well as my love of Grail lore.
Right.
And my was going to be on and this is an exercise for magicians. Go out there, get a hot glue gun, get some epoxy glue, paint, and start creating objects that are fantasy. Like you've seen my little time machine. It's just it's a bunch of junk, and I put together the giant wheel, and it's actually got a music box motor on it. And unfortunately, it only plays Edelweiss, which is I wish I'd been a cooler song. But that's what I got. But the little wheel spins like the wheel in the George Powell.
Do you remember we were talking about those little wind-up things and I couldn't remember what the name of it was? They're music box movements. That's what they're called. So if you're looking for more and you want to...
No, I think it's kind of cool.
I mean, your time machine is pretty amazing looking, and I don't think you need to make another one. I love that it plays Edelweiss, personally.
Yeah.
But should you ever decide that you would like the Fantastic Dream or something like that, you know, or the Impossible Dream or something like that, you know.
And then the hourglasses that I made. I made an hourglass where the flow can be altered, so it can go flow fast or slow.
Wow.
And actually, speaking of narrative affecting reality, I just happened to, when I was driving yesterday, one of my teaching company lectures talked about Edelweiss because apparently the original song that was the anthem, it's a completely different song and they played a bit and it's just this really dreadful sort of boom, 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 boom.
Awesome.
Kind of song.
The Von Trapp family actually
not
sound?
Not soft and white at all.
It's not at all. So when they did it for the movie, they completely wrote a new song to get this wonderful, you know, beautiful, flowy thing. And now it's like so replaced the original that, I mean, Austrians consider it all the time their unofficial national anthem, and nobody knows the original anymore.
They
use the one from the movie.
You know where else that happened? It happened in West Side Story. Mm-hmm. In West Side Story, this is true. If you ever see the original musical, Krupke comes early in the play. No, sorry. Cool comes early in the play. Boy, that's boy, right. Crazy boy. Mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. Krupke's after the rumble.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And when they were making the movie, they're going, well, this is kind of weird, them playing such a, you know, he's, you know, Riff has just been killed. And right. now we're doing G-Officer Krupke.
Yeah.
So they switched it. Mm-hmm. And they put Krupke early in the movie and Cool towards the end.
But now that's most theater affecting theater. Yeah. Now I'm
but now most productions do that.
Actual history. Country's yeah. you know,
identity
and you know the way they see themselves and their national song,
mm-hmm.
you know, was completely changed by this movie.
Well, Rodgers and Hammerstein, you can't beat them. You know.
Yeah, I know. I thought Jet Song was our national song.
Yeah.
When you're a... No, I mean, look, we're the most ridiculous country in the world as far as national anthems. We have the only national anthem in the world that contains a high E, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, it depends on... It's a full song. Octave from where you start.
Yeah, it's yeah. like it's like this incredible range of singing our national mm-hmm. anthem. It's, I just crack it. Like, you know, who would have... so where were... Okay, we're talking about...
We were actually talking about your character lecture.
Well,
and I was trying to get you to talk about it because it's fascinating, and you were bringing up pieces that are in it, at least in the notes that I read, because unfortunately I didn't get to see it, but I loved reading it. That was my airplane read, and I was digging it, because you talk a lot about, not only do you give magicians working examples of, with your newspaper tear, for example,
right.
how you personally have a feeling about newspapers. And everybody feels something, whether they don't like the way it smells, they hate that it gets ink on their hands, but you specifically feel how about newspapers?
Well, I do really have OCD. I joke about that, but it's the truth. And I suffer anxiety reactions on occasion. Mm-hmm. Not often, but I do. And the news really gets to me, and
this is the truth.
Yes, yeah. I am.
He gets so upset. By the
being news. An artist and a rationalist, I'm a liberal because I mean that's mm-hmm. the only thing that goes. People say, "Oh, it's you know," but I came from Orange County, so I grew up in a conservative family,
mm-hmm.
and I watch television and I watch the news shows, and it makes me angry. It's just such nonsense. I mean, the whole point of our government was always compromise. And there's no compromise anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No one, I mean, it's like, wait a second. They talk about the founding fathers and they don't know anything about the founding fathers.
Right.
But again, Mike, it was funny because you went into one of the course of human events from the opening of the Declaration of Independence. All right. Rush Limbaugh gets this award from CPAC for defense of the Constitution. And in the speech, acceptance speech, he implies that, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, and they're endowed by the created by certain inalienable rights. That life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is in the preamble to the Constitution. It's not. It's the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
And it's like, what, you're giving a defense of the Constitution award to a guy that doesn't even know what the preamble sounds like?
Oh, it was my
like,
gosh.
I mean, it's just like, my hair goes on end when
I
hear that.
Yeah, well, there's so many people that don't know
that you're digressing from your news.
I know, but so... right, but So I had to, you know, my psychiatrist said, you got to stop watching news shows and you don't read the newspaper just because it just affects you too deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the traditional newspaper tear has always been this very clean, neat, mm-hmm. almost anal retentive presentation with ripping the paper in these perfect little strips and down again and down again. And I thought, well, wait a second, here's an idea, you know. So I go out in front of the audience and I say, you know, I have OCD and I'm not supposed to read newspapers. But when I pick one up, like I travel, I get one at the airport and it makes me angry. And I've got to deal with that. And here's how I deal with it. And I take the newspaper and I rip it to shreds in front of the audience. But more than that, I become an advocate. I go down to the audience and hand parts of the newspaper and say, rip it. Now, don't you feel better? Yes!
Yeah.
It's catharsis, you know. And then when I get the paper back, it's this shredded mess, mm-hmm. and then I crush it together and open it up, and it's completely restored, new and clean.
Hmm.
Well, it looks so much better than the neat ripping, which almost looks
methodical.
Thank you all. I have a high IQ, but I just can't speak that well because I'm thinking 20 miles ahead of my tongue.
His brain outstrips his tongue.
That's true. So,
streaking brain, sprinting tongue.
It's more methodical. It feels like the audience could could imagine, oh, this is how he's planning out to do it. But when it's chaos, it's just terrible.
That's right.
You have no idea how it's going to happen.
It makes the restoration so much more magical. Right. Yeah. And the story's true.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I would confront magicians and say, we all have those stories. I go, look, and I would point to a person and say, what are your hobbies? Mm-hmm. What's your favorite movie? What do you like? Now, what magic do you do? I said, okay. And I would, with person after person, take some story in their life and show them how to turn that into a presentation of magic that they do so that it's real for them. Hey. And they never think of this. They grab the trick, they look at the pattern, and magic pattern for magic tricks is like it was written by idiots because it's the most inane, you know.
Yeah,
you
know, like bad stand-up.
It is bad stand-up. It's like they went into the Robert Orban books and they found the worst jokes, and Robert Orban,
Muggsy's chasing rabbits.
Yeah, well, Muggsy's reading Robert. Orban.
Yeah.
Muggsy's going, those jokes are terrible.
You know,
and he gets the worst, they find the worst one-liners in those books, because there are some zingers, but they don't find them. And then they put them in this. So yeah, the pattern. And there are some, every once in a while you read it and you go, hey, you know, that's interesting. But it's not your story. And one of the things that you strongly advocate is write your story. And I have not seen a stronger advocate that lives his words than you. In all aspects of everything you do. And it's so simple, and it's on such an elemental level that you can do exactly what you just described doing, which is point at someone and say, what's your story? Why aren't you telling us that story? Because that's the you I get to know, and that's what makes you who you are. And you have been 100% who you are, and it's why I love working with you, and it's why I love your magic.
The thing that makes me upset about the people that get involved with news nowadays is the hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And I refuse to be a hypocrite. And so, but I mean, I don't get to the point where that, because sometimes that can be a dodge. But I don't teach stuff I never use. A lot of people's lectures are, here's 10 tricks I've never done in my life. I don't want to teach you the tricks I actually do in my life because I don't want you to compete with me.
So or here's 40 things that you can do with a plastic ring and a rope.
That's right. Mm.
It's, because they're cheap to pass out today.
That's right.
You know?
We can sell them for 25 bucks a piece.
When I was putting lectures together, I went to a lot of other guys that did lectures. I go, what do I do? And he said, well, you got to come up with a cheap little trick that you can sell for like 10 bucks because that's what people will buy. Yeah. And I go, I'm not interested in doing that.
Right.
And they go, why? I said, my name's going to be on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The advice that I'm giving is what I'll be remembered for. I don't want to be remembered for a cheap little trick that goes into a Ziploc bag and costs 10 bucks. I want to be remembered for things, you know. Salvador Dali says, don't vomit on your paintings because after you're dead, they'll come back and vomit on you. Mm-hmm. Which isn't the nicest way to say that, but he makes the point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you think of your works in such a manner, after you're dead, it's going to, you know, come back to, not to mix metaphors, to haunt you. And,
sure.
And I won't ever do that.
Sometimes people have asked me, will you come and speak about writing or writing comic books or screenplay writing or will you share your you know, secrets with us? And it's like, I have no secrets. I can't explain how to do it. Mm-hmm. You just do it. I can't take what I do that people have gravitated toward and that I think I'm doing a good job when I'm telling a story and package that in a little soup can and hand that out, or even distill that and make it into like a 20-minute talk.
Well, and part of the reason for that is I have seen you, just like I have seen Jonathan, time and again, take things that are happening to you in your life and make them happen to Batman. Not in the exact same way. You create a metaphor from what you're personally feeling. There's vitriol about some specific situation, and you create a villain.
Yeah.
There's pain and agony, and you give it to this character. Not necessarily always Batman, but you give it to someone in his rogues gallery or to something that you're personally writing. And those are the stories that become iconic for you as a writer.
Yeah.
And those are the stories that become iconic for you, and I'm pointing at Jonathan now, as a magician.
Take something that's important to you, whether it's something you're going through on an emotional level or a person you're having sparks with in your life, you know, for better or for worse, and that how that affects your character, and craft your story out of that. You know, I can't come up with any other secret to my writing other than that. You know, any more than that, it's a matter of discipline. You have to spend X amount of hours.
Button chair, fingers on keyboard.
Yeah, you have to actually write the sucker.
Well, and it goes back to that adage that we're using around the house, which is execute first and edit later. Because if you get into editing mode, it's very easy to not produce anything because you get involved in the minutia. And that has been a problem for me specifically for years, going back to you and I, Jonathan, have discussed discipline. and not being able for either lack of confidence, and you get stuck in a cycle of self-doubt, or you determine that the product that you're putting out there is just not worthy of being seen. And it's the greatest story that was never told. You know, not that, you know what I'm saying. Not that the ultimate product is so wonderful, but if you can't produce anything, you can't move on from there.
I'm not the biggest.
And what have you left behind? Nothing. You've left behind this potential that you never actualized. I'm sorry for
interrupting. I'm not the biggest fan of the Cars movies, but, you know, the tow truck says, get her done. Just, that's it, you know.
Uh-huh. Sorry, the cable guy says,
get her done. Just finish the damn thing. Mm-hmm. And don't stew over it. And don't, you know, take time off to do it. You have a job. You are finishing a story, and if that story is 400 pages, or if it's a short story of 20 pages, just write till you get it finished. It's like an unfinished story is like living in a half-finished house, and you want to get that roof up before it rains.
But the
go ahead.
The competency always shows often in the simplicity of the end product. Although there's nothing simplistic about creating it. It required hard work and thought and experience to be able to get your words and your ideas so well said into the package the audience sees. Oh, I mean, it's like Iron Giant.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm crying when even today. I mean, we watched it about 3 weeks ago, and I said, I'm going to cry. I always cry at this movie, and it's an animated, but it has such a simple story. But I'm sure that the work that went behind it was anything but simple. And the thought that went behind it was anything but simple.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it is work. But I'll tell you, when you're really involved in a creative endeavor and you really got your teeth into it and you're clawing away at it, you enjoy the process so much that you don't mind the hours spent. It doesn't become a toil. It becomes a puzzle, you know, or a game. And it's saying you want to solve the game. And I wrote a movie recently, an animated film, and I looked, in doing some rework on it the other day, I looked back at some other drafts, and I couldn't believe, even though the story is very close, how tight the third draft is now to the first, and how much I liked the third draft. And I liked what I was writing in the first draft. It's just that I knew that some of it was going to get chopped out, and some of it was going to get redone, and some of it was going to get, you know, I'd come up with better ideas. So allow yourself the chance to get those better ideas once it's done. Go back and read it and then finesse it and then do the fine tuning. Don't fine tune when you write. It's
finish page 120, then go back and think about 5.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's really fascinating. Yeah. And how many people in creative endeavors that haven't quite broken through and produced their first show or finished their first novel, but they consider themselves writers. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of that story Ray Fox told me. Ray, F-A-W-K-E-S, is a writer and he does graphic novels as well. And we met him in Canada and he's a dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he was telling me once that he met Harlan Ellison?
Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, Harlan, whom I love and have spoken to very saltily on the telephone.
Has he sued you yet?
Saltily is generally fine.
Has he sued you yet?
No, oh God.
He'll get to it.
No, he's in the middle of other litigation with other people, which he tells me all about. But he called here and he was like, hey, Paul wrote this comic book. And I'd never met the guy before. And he calls the house and he goes, Paul wrote this comic book. I said, yeah. And he goes, how many other variant covers did you get? I said, who is this? Who the hell is this? And he's like, well, I'm Harlan Ellison. I said,
like, duh.
And who's that? And he was like, and he's just like, you know, and so my friend Ruth went on a date with him once.
Of course.
And she's very salty and can certainly hold her own. And as part of the date, it was going quite well. And he said, I want to take you somewhere. And she's like, okay, this is interesting. We'll go on a journey with this guy. He takes her to a bookstore and he says, I want to buy you some of my books. And she says, well, I guess somebody's got to buy them. And he immediately took her home.
End of
and
date.
And date was over. So, but anyway, what was I saying before? How do we get into this?
Crap.
He wrote my favorite Outer Limits segment, Demon with the Glass Hand, with Robert Paul.
Harlan Ellison, why would we ring him up?
Was the time travel.
Ray Fox. Okay, so Ray Fox, the reason I brought Harlan Ellison up was not just to tell you that entertaining story about Ruth, although it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
And very Ruth, if you know Ruth.
And then he sued the bookstore.
He sued Ruth. And he'll probably sue us for mentioning him in this podcast. But actually, he's a really nice guy, and he's been great to us. But anyway, Ray was at a Comic-Con, I don't know which one, and Harlan was a guest. Mm-hmm. And Ray is a writer, and he's a damn good one. And there was a kid in front of him in line who fancied himself a writer. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference. There's a very stark difference between the two.
Yes.
And Harlan is a no bullshit kind of guy.
He does not suffer fools.
He does not suffer fools, and he does not mince words. And the person in front of Ray brought a book for Harlan to sign, and Harlan was signing it. And he says, I'm a writer. And Harlan says, interesting. What have you written? And the guy goes, well, I've got this idea for a novel. And he said, what have you finished? And the kid said, well, I have three or four projects started. And Harlan said, stop wasting my time. You're not a writer until you've finished at least one story. Next. That was it. And Ray said he had not finished a story yet and kept his mouth shut. But Harlan Ellison was the reason he finished his stories, because he said, I am a writer. And if that's what it takes, I'm going to start finishing. And it moved him along. He also told me that great Alan Moore time management story that I told you guys on here once.
Well, you'll have to tell me after. I won't make you repeat it for people
but,
who've already seen
but
it.
But it was, you are or you're not. And you are what you do. And if you are spending a ton of time researching or learning triviata about, or, you know, speaking of creative endeavors specifically, like if you are consuming magic and you are like Milbourne Christopher and you know it, you know, you're writing and you're well, I don't necessarily, you know, just to name a name, he's an historian, for those of you who don't know, has written a few historical books on magic and things. But if you're finding that you're consuming magic and are becoming an expert in who's done what and what the derivation of or the original origination of this effect was, maybe that's what you do. Maybe you're not a magician. Maybe you're an academic and you can start writing books about, or maybe you can parlay that into something that's an adjacent, because you'll find that you have natural proclivities. If I don't perform, Jonathan, you're probably like this too. If I don't perform, I get the shakes. And me I'm like, too. Man, somebody's got to see me do something now. Yeah. I gotta get a clap or something. You know?
Yeah,
like,
you're driven to perform. He's never happy unless he's working on magic. And he's happiest when he is on stage. I told him early on, it's like, I have no fear about other women in his life. His mistress is the stage.
Yes.
You know, that's, there's a level of life that exists in him when he is on stage that I do not see at any other time. And it sort of makes me a little jealous. You know?
He shines. Like, you know, I mean, he steps out on stage and you can't, I mean, it's the audience just goes, I want to go where he's going.
Yeah.
Since we were speaking about the Grove earlier, I did a poetry recital at the Grove. Cause you have all these, it's gotten a lot of bad press because there's a lot of rich
Republicans
there, but the people that come there are often, you know, academics and artists, and it's this beautiful, beautiful Grove.
Oh, Jimmy Buffett is a member.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's an amazing experience.
Well, it was started in the 1870s. I mean, the term bohemian meant people who, by their very nature, did not have any money, but a passion for the arts. And so the club was founded to, foster that and to be a refuge for writers, for painters, and for journalists.
And how it became such an enclave of political...
And again, Mark Twain was one of the founding members.
That's an interesting question.
It should also be mentioned it's men only.
I'm just saying. I wish that would change.
But I have no problems with it. I think it's cool.
I want to tell one more thing about the club, and I don't think I'm betraying any... Of course I am, but because it's all very secretive. But anyway, just to show the good spirit in which it was founded initially. At the club in San Francisco, there is a stage. And have you been to the...
Yes, I performed at the City, the City Club.
The City Club. Off to the side, there are these great stained glass images that show people in the arts. And there's a writer sitting, in thought as he composes. And at his feet, in the stained glass, are rejection slips at the bottom, you know, rejection, rejection, rejection. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the stage is a beautiful stained glass of an actor on stage pouring his heart out. And what you don't see at the bottom is whistling toward him are cabbages, tomatoes, things like that. Oh, and it's done
for the love of performance.
Yes, and it's done totally seriously.
That's fabulous.
Because, you know, to show, you know, the bohemian is a struggling artist who is met with brickbats, who is not... whose music is not appreciated and everything. And over time, because it became a place for the literary members of the American West at that time, because it was the 1870s, so, you know, everybody, you know, San Francisco and everything, it was this bastion of civilization in the Old West. It attracted more of the city's patrons. And so that's when he had the influx of old money, and then it became really split between the true bohemians and the guys with a lot of capital to spend who built the club and the mm-hmm. grove, bought the grove
and made it what it is.
Mm-hmm. Made it what it is, but
the true worse. The true bohemian spirit is still there.
Yes, it's, absolutely.
It's, and you feel it when you go there.
Did you want to talk about your poetry?
Well, this was interesting because this is the Bohemian Club was an experience. There was one of the things that said, okay, I'm going to go tell stories now. I was hired to come. I wasn't hired. You don't, you know, you volunteer, but
you're invited.
You're invited. Mm-hmm. That's right. It's not, you're not hired. You do this out of love. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To work on a production. We did a production of Merlin. It was an original musical written for it. And me and Patrick Martin were one of my best friends, a magician from San Francisco area. And he is a member of the club. We're up there. And I recited some of my poetry for fun. And then someone said, "What could you come to our camp tomorrow at lunchtime, have lunch with us, and then do some of your poetry readings?" And I said, "Oh, I'd love to do that." So I came the next day, and I recite some other, T.S. Eliot and Edgar Allan Poe, and some of my own work, you know. But I have stories about all of them mm-hmm. that are really personal stories to me.
Yeah.
And I gave this presentation, and they were really a great audience. Uh-huh. So midnight that night, there was one camp that is famous for an alcoholic drink whose ingredients are a top secret. However, you're told very quickly it's basically hot chocolate and Bacardi 151. Yes, you know.
I'm giving away secrets.
You said the word, not me. We are the knights who say Nick. No. Remember, he said not me.
Microchips in your brain.
I was not going to say it.
A swarm of owls is going to be waiting outside to fly you away.
That's right. The owls. No, but the thing about the secrecy about the club is that it's not like, oh, we know something you don't know. Again, there's a privacy because a lot of these people are very, very famous, and this is their place to get away from it.
Yeah.
And it's just rude to talk about it. But this midnight experience.
That's how I'd imagine, because there's also a bonding and
sharing. There is very much a bonding. Yeah. And so I'm sitting at this campfire having one of these drinks, and it's late at night and it's cold, and this is like very warming and there's good conversation, and a guy sits down next to me I've never actually met before.
Yeah.
And the guy says, "You don't know me from Adam, but I'm a New York headhunter, and I get paid a lot of money to find people who have talent." Mm-hmm. And you don't know, but when you left, you know, they talked about you. About what you said and how you said it in your field. And I have some advice for you. Write. Before you explode from what's inside you, get it out. Because mm-hmm. you've got something to say. And trust me, this is my business. And I'm going, and you could tell the guy wasn't bullshitting me. He was, and he really meant this.
Yeah.
And I sat there with this drink in my hand going, oh my God. And that really was really the genesis of this. I'm going to do this now. Yeah. I'm going to do this now. And part of the reasons for the suicidal experience was people in my life who were keeping me from evolving into this character that I wanted to, because they so much wanted to be me to be the character I was when in my 30s and my 40s. And I was dying. I, you know, Nietzsche says stagnation is death. I always say stagnation is artistic death. But it's mm-hmm. I was dying because my art was stagnating, and because I knew where I wanted to go. I knew what this character was. I knew everything about this character, and I was trapped, not only by this person but by other people who wanted the legacy of the Jonathan mm-hmm. Pendragon in his 30s and 40s, who was a grinning fool with Earl Flynn, who would leap tall buildings in a single bound, and I didn't want to play that part anymore.
Well, it wasn't who you were anymore.
No, it wasn't who I was anymore. And I felt trapped in this legacy. Mm-hmm. And it took an extreme incident, a horrible, horrible time, the lowest time of my entire life, to free me, though, from that past life into something where I could do this now. And finding a woman like West, who is so into that, who so understands it, who, you know, is so bright that, you know, we finish each other's sentences and, you know, and I'll say, did you know this? She goes, of course I knew that. Mm-hmm. She goes, did you know that? I go, of course I knew that. You know, as eclectic as I am. Mm-hmm. And you know, who's brought me closer to people like Paul and Misty, mm-hmm. and now Neil Gaiman and others, who were the people who, you know, some of my very earliest memories, mm-hmm. they were my real heroes. Mm-hmm. The writers, those words that were in front of me, that I, mm-hmm. that, as a kid with OCD who didn't want people around him because he was afraid of physical touch, my refuge, my sanctuary, I think of Charles Laughton, you know, sanctuary, you know,
from, yeah, mm-hmm. a big ordain,
was the library, mm-hmm. and I would grab a book and I would read it, and that's how I escaped.
Yeah,
and so now, that's now part of my life, and it's. It's amazing.
Well, in so many cultures, and this is the thing he's been learning that I've been trying to tell him about. In so many cultures, the ritual of initiation has to do with a descent into the underworld, a descent into...
And a death.
Hell, mm-hmm. and a death. And you have to have that before you can ascend Phoenix. Again mm-hmm. and really become...
Mm-hmm. You know, Phoenix burns up
yeah.
before it rises from the and ashes.
That's what I mean. There is so much that was so horrible about, you know, the time that he likes to refer to as wandering in the wilderness. But
yes.
he could not be doing what he's doing now if he had not gone through that.
No,
and I think he's starting to realize it. So.
And it's amazing yeah. because he just talked about having almost died so many times. And then mm-hmm. he died this spiritual death and was reborn.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't want to say literally because, you know,
in Nana, it's Orpheus, it's...
It is.
You know, it's and all it's, of that.
You know, and who's to say you didn't die that day that you attempted suicide because you were born someone else when you woke up. You were on your own. You were surrounded by white in a sterile environment. And it was like, that's how a baby comes into the world.
Well, I still had a little time in purgatory after that. But yeah,
well, absolutely.
Yes,
I'm not saying it was perfect. Babies don't like to be born. They cry. Mm-hmm. You know? But it's really remarkable where you've been because we knew you on the other side. And now we know you on this one. Mm-hmm. And we've loved you on both ends. That sounds strange. I don't want to cut.
Kinky.
I'll own it. Yeah, someone, yes, you know, someone was talking about the VIP tickets at the Academy of Magical Arts Awards today at lunch. And he said, well, and you two in your VIP-ness. And I said, what? And I said, no. And he goes,
or what?
Yeah, and that's what I said. And I didn't even
get it.
I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
I didn't even hear the trail end of it. Like, I didn't put the organ to it. And I was just like, I just thought it was a funny term. Like, I was thinking, like, conduct happiness, like the little P that I wear on the T-shirts. And then it occurred to me that he had said penis, and I went, oh, it was so childish.
You had a Beavis moment. Beavis. Oh, yeah.
So I'll own it. But anyway, we have known you on both sides of your journey. And at that time, when I knew you before, because we were sort of, you know, we hadn't been in contact for several years, and Wes was one of the reasons that we were able to, thank God, reunite and rekindle what we had, you know, back then in a very different and wonderfully deep way that anyway.
It's funny because every time I hear the other side, I'm going to make this reference because I can't, I love this ridiculous scene in Predator 2.
Okay.
Can
we also say how much you love the Cats with Thumbs commercial?
Oh, I love the Cats with Thumbs.
Okay, because
I love the
they're about the
because
same.
Because I have a polydactyl cat.
I know
a polydactyl
you do,
cat,
but
so,
anyway.
So, remember this scene? This is Danny Glover, isn't it? Danny Glover is the cop.
I will never see it.
Okay. And he wants to talk to the voodoo lord, who is this very famous black actor who's been in a lot of different films. And he's playing this, like, Rastafarian. He's got the dreadlocks, mm-hmm. and he's got a cane. Mm-hmm. And he's got a name like, I can't, what's the name? It's...
we'll call him Fred.
Well, no, it's
like a Baron Samedi?
Yeah, like something, but not that, but similar. And the actor just gives this. I mean, just rent the movie and watch the scene because the actor is this wonderful portrayal, and he's got this cane, and he goes, "I don't know who he is, but I know where he is." You know, and the guy, Danny Glover goes, "Where?" He goes, "On the other side."
Oh yeah.
You know, and he goes, "Prepare yourself. This is dread, man. True dread." Mm-hmm. And I know the actor from because he's Shakespearean trained.
Sure.
For more serious stuff.
However, like, dear.
Yeah.
Misty was making a point.
It's funny because
deflecting because this is heavy stuff.
I know. Yeah, I just love that portrayal because it's But I mean, I'm even doing the impersonating his voice, but just go rent the movie and get to the part where Danny Glover is talking to the head of the voodoo guy, and that scene there is like, it's great.
Or just YouTube it because you don't.
Just the best
moment in the Disney movie, the Princess and the Frog is the voodoo guy in that movie where he's conjuring. He talks about the friends on the other side, and he's in touch with the voodoo spirit world, and
that doesn't work out well for him though.
Mm-hmm. Well, he made the wrong friends.
Well, and he also reneged on what he said he was going to do. Yeah. But anyway,
Baron Zombie is a fascinating character. I mean, because I studied that stuff too. It's really,
I'm not down with the zombies that chase people and go like, but the zombies that are conjured up out of the swamps and the Haitian zombies, right. And those zombies and the voodoo and everything. I'm down with that. That's the interesting stuff.
Okay, but I was talking about Jonathan. Okay. And what I was going to say is, I knew you then, and you were beginning the crossing of the bridge, if you will. You know, like you were on your way, and I saw moments of tremendous sadness in you, and then I saw you come to life, and I watched the dichotomy of those two things, and it was like a push me pull you sort of situation that you were in at that time. And one of the things that I said to Paul was, I looked very forward to you finally, like after we had stopped working together for a while, I said, I look very forward to the Jonathan that embraces the fact that he has become the guru and he's no longer a student and he will always learn for the rest of his life. But I really saw you come to life when you consulted on my show. And my show was a mess. Like, I mean, it was like, you know, 7 years ago, and there might have been good moments in it, but I was learning too. And this is years and years ago. But he sat up in the balcony and he watched one rehearsal and he said, and literally he just sat up there like this, like with his arms crossed. And he came down and he said, you've got tremendous stage presence and I see a lot of really positive things. And he goes, now, here's where I perceive there are problems. And he goes, number one, this, and he just went, blah, 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 blah. And not only did he present, he said, here's where I see a problem. Here are three potential solutions. Mm-hmm. And he said, and here's what I perceive. And he, as an artistic director, said, here's an artistic way to make an easy audience followable transition that tells a story. And he said, there's a long transition here. How about, since she's moving into something that is Japanese in theme, we have a setting sun. Do you have this kind of music? And it was boom, 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 boom. And I watched his, it was like his head in the Bill Cosby sketch, Dad is Great, He Gives Us Chocolate Cake. He talks about how his wife's head split and green light came out of her hair. And it was the exact same thing, but in a completely different way. You were having a creative conniption.
I get to see him do this so often. Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing to watch.
It's amazing. And it's really
addictive. I got hired to go to Vegas to work on Hans Klok's show. They had this huge... illusion.
And this was like 2 or 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, yeah, they had this huge illusion, which was basically vanishing a bunch of girls inside of a miniature Eiffel Tower that was still, you know, about 20 feet tall. It was a huge prop in the center section. These girls were going to vanish. And when you watch it, it got almost no applause because the choreography was erratic. The lighting designer was a top-notch lighting designer, but he'd done musicals. He'd done, like, you know, Phantom of the Opera. I mean, he never really had lit magic before. And so I got there, and the LD came up to me and said, I'm aware of your reputation. I really am looking forward to working with you because you can teach me stuff I don't know. I mean, a positive experience, which if I was going in to meet somebody that, you know, that could teach me something I didn't know, I'd be exactly the same way.
Yeah.
I wouldn't act like, I said, well, wait, I can learn something from you. And this is like really, really great. So we sat down there, we worked on the lighting together, and I had one of my laser pointers, you know, the green one. And I was saying, okay, well, let's use this light. And he goes, what's that? He goes, it's a laser pointer. He said, I can point to whatever light I want and create circles on the phone. He goes, how do you get those? He goes, you go on the internet. I'll give you the site later on. He goes, I'm buying one tonight. So this is a professional LD. And he goes, that is the coolest tool I've ever seen for lighting. And I showed him later on, and he went on the computer and he ordered a laser pointer for helping with the lighting and all that kind of stuff. So we're talking, we just have a great time, and we get the thing well lit. Now I get down there, and I got to go with the choreographer. The choreographer is not the same experience. She is like one of these people, I said, well, what is this guy going to teach me about dance or movement?
Oh.
And I said, so I sit down, I said, I'm not being arrogant or pushy. I'm saying, well, the problem is the audience doesn't know how many people are getting into that prop because there's so much motion on stage. We're not pointing to, now it's full. We've got this many people inside. So when the vanish comes, we realize the difference in the situation on stage. You've got it going so fast, they could be watching something completely different and they're not focused on it.
There's no story.
Yeah. So we need to put those women that are going to be vanished into a situation where we can look at them for a second before we vanish them. And she's going like, well, what would you suggest? And she's mm-hmm. a little arrogant about it. And I look at the women, I go, well, how about Cell Block Tango?
Mm-hmm.
And she looks at me like, oh. Because immediately yep. she realizes what I'm saying.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Oh, this guy's smarter than I thought. Mm-hmm. It was that kind of an attitude. He goes, okay. And we put them in the line, and the girls do the motion, and one by one, they go up the stairs and get it, and they fill the prop. And that night, the effect goes on, and it gets a thunderous applause. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm patting myself on the back.
No, but, you're not. You're but, explaining but it's, why
but
it's I'm, important to
learn. But I understood the staging, but mm-hmm. my background in theater, my background in lighting. And the good thing about the experience was there was this one guy who was saying, yeah, I'm a hotshot lighting designer, but I can always learn something. I can always grow in my thought. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can evolve. And the other person is going, well, I dare you, show me. And of course, it just struck me how different those two experiences were. Because the lighting designer, we had such a great time.
Yeah, and you are
so nice guy.
Yeah, and you are so uniquely qualified to do this stuff because of your life experience, but also the choices that you've made. And this is the final episode in our chapter about writing your own story. And this has been like an overall arc. And I can't even express my gratitude to you enough. And I'm sure I speak for both of us, all four of us, really, Ezra and Emily, too. We'd love to have you guys back on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
You both have such a... Anytime. It's been fun. God.
You are mm-hmm. so tremendous and wonderful, and we are really, really grateful that you spent some time with us tonight.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter @RadioRashi or @Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.